Good morning, church.
Good morning.
Good to see each one of you here this morning, especially for you that are visitors with us this morning. Welcome as we worship God together. If you have been attending the church, you know that we're working through 2 Samuel. And if you haven't been attending this church, we're working our way through 2 Samuel. So if you would turn in your Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 13, but I want to say a couple of words, a couple of things before we get into this chapter. Now, I've titled my sermon, Sin, Dysfunction, and Family Secrets. Another title of it could be something like, How Family Sins Ruins Lives and Perverts God's Plan to Restore People to a Right Relationship with God and with each other. Well, that wouldn't fit on the bulletin very well. Last Sunday, we took a deep dive into the word sin because we looked at 2 Samuel 12, in which you have David's adultery and murder. And so we looked at the word, what the word sin actually means. And the Hebrew word kata, we saw how it means missing the mark. So it can be used in a moral sense of like adultery and murder. Or it can mean, like, if you're pretty good with a slingshot. And I talked about the tribe of Benjamin had 700 soldiers who were left-handed. I don't know if they probably trained everybody to be left-handed. I don't know. But who could, with a sling, could, like, not miss the mark. And they would, like, within a hair miss, they were that good with a slingshot. And that word is used there. So it just means sin, just means just. It means missing the mark that we have. So what is the mark? And we talked about that last Sunday. So a couple more comments about this specific content. I'm going to try to work through these chapters of Samuel 13, 14, 15, the three chapters. So I'll be kind of going through those three chapters this morning. But a couple of things here. First, these chapters are not the high point of the book. The high point of the book is in actually chapter 7, where God promises David that he would start this sort of royal family that would go on and on. And in chapter 7, David's son would come after him and build this house of worship, and his kingdom would essentially have no end. Now, we know now that Jesus the Christ is the actual son, the real son of David. And it is God's kingdom given to us through Jesus Christ, which we're serving. We're not serving the house of David anymore. But that is the high point of the book of 2 Samuel, is chapter 7. It's where it kind of everything culminates in that, and then things start to unwind from that. And we'll see how that, we started yesterday, last Sunday with the unwinding. We'll see how it really unwinds even more in these next couple of chapters. The second thing I want to say is that the Bible doesn't hold back on descriptions of human depravity. If you just want to, you know, if you don't have any questions about how sinful we can be, just read these couple of chapters again when you go back home. The Bible tells us these stories, but they're not given to us so we imitate this behavior. They're given to us so we learn from this behavior, how not to live, right? It doesn't bless everything it narrates in the Bible. And certainly most of the choices and events in these 7 chapters or so, and I'll do the next 4 chapters, hopefully next Sunday, most of the things are deeply evil and sinful that we see in these chapters. Third, God has recorded these stories so we can learn how to live. It narrates a lot of things wrong, and so it's trying to help us saying, this is the bad target. Don't miss the good target, is what the Bible is trying to tell us here. Fourth, again, the title of my sermon helps us understand that what we need are things like discernment and discipline in order to prevent the dysfunction of that can be in families and the secrets that we have in our families that help extend the dysfunction sometimes. Fifth, in Jeremiah 31 that Levon read, that passage describes the larger purposes that God has given to us. It's to undo the exile, and because this is written, Jeremiah 31 is written to the children of Israel in exile, and it's to give them the hope that when they come back, they will be able to come back into a right relationship with God and with each other in the proper worship of God. And then the Ephesians 4 reading, Paul describes how we're to live. It's a practical kind of thing about attitudes and thoughts and choices and the way we live our life so that we can be transformed to work for the good of others. That's the goal, to work for the good of others. But this chapter, 2 Samuel 13, describes what we can only call, using modern language, a very dysfunctional family. By dysfunction, I simply mean this web of abuse and conflict and bad behaviors, misbehaviors that come from various sins in the family. And I think we can learn something about how to prevent dysfunction in our families today if we look at the discernment and the discipline patterns that, or lack of, mostly lack of, that we see in these stories. And by discernment, I simply mean the ability to judge well, in everyday life between right and wrong, or some things that are smart and foolish sometimes. By discipline, I simply mean the ability and the training to obey moral rules. Discipline is the ability to obey moral rules. David did not discipline his sons, his boys. He spoiled them, and he was a poor example to boot. Lack of discipline all over the place in these stories. So I want to tell you a story about discernment, the ability to judge well, right? So in June of this year, 12,000 feet under the surface of the sea, a submersible named Titan imploded. They were out there looking for the Titanic, you know, the famous wreck of the Titanic. The skipper of this submersible, who was also the founder and director of the company that produced the submersible, boasted proudly that he was skirting rules about, good engineering rules about, like, the materials you should use to build something that would go down that deep. And, like, the materials and the design, right? He had this newfangled design, which, So don't get in that submersible, right? Use some good discernment and don't get in that submersible. And so 12,500 feet, it imploded, and their bodies were instantly, liquefied. An example of poor discernment. You don't have to be an engineer to know that you probably shouldn't get in something like that. Common sense will tell you that. So just, that's really, 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 really poor discernment. So these chapters are a case study in family dysfunction and the dysfunction that we can see some in our own families sometimes. So 2 Samuel 13, first verse. In the course of time, Amnon, son of David, fell in love with Tamar, the beautiful sister of Absalom. Now I want to say a couple things here. Absalom is really the center of the story of the next about seven chapters. It's really about Absalom and about how Absalom wants to become the next king. We'll see that as we go through. Absalom also is very handsome. Tamar, his sister, his full sister, is very beautiful. Amnon is a half-brother to both Absalom and Tamar. Verse 2. Enter, well, Amnon, it says, verse 2, Amnon became so obsessed with his sister Tamar that he made himself ill. She was a virgin, and it seemed impossible for him to do anything to her. So then we have, verse 3, Jonadab comes in. Now, Jonadab is a cousin, right? He's David's nephew. He's a son of one of David's sisters. He's a crafty man, it says. He was shrewd. And he knows what's going on here. He is discerning, but he's using his discernment for evil. He discerns that Amnon is not feeling love for his half-sister, but lust. And he says, oh, Amnon, just pretend that you're sick And, you know, you just need some peace and quiet and maybe a visit from people you love. And you know, Tamar can go and help you out there. She can visit you, wink, wink. And then, you know, just work at that. And so Amnon does that. He pretends to be sick. And then isn't it interesting that Jonadab tells David that Amnon is sick and needs somebody like maybe Tamar to go visit him. And so David visits him, and Amnon says, oh yes, my migraine headache is really bad, and I just need to be in I'm going to stay in my bedroom, and I just need, you know, by the way, could you just send Tamar to see me, and, you know, I'd just like to nibble on some of her, these tasty cakes that she makes. And so David says, yeah, sure. I'm sure she'll be happy to help you out here. You're feeling so bad. And so it's also, you see how this is all getting set up, right? And so Tamar does. Tamar is, in verse 6, Amnon lays down. David sends word to Tamar in verse 7, go to the palace of your brother Amnon, prepare food. So Tamar goes, and she's trying to help out here. He's lying down. She takes bread and dough and kneads it and so forth and so on. David, shockingly, I think, shows a lack of discernment here. If Jonadab knew what was going on, if Absalom, we learn later that Absalom knew what was going on too, why didn't David know what's going on here? Verse 10, Amnon said to Tamar, bring the food here in my bedroom. I'm here. I've got this. I need to have some quiet, and I got this migraine headache, and it's so bad. Just come and bring it into my bedroom here. And so she takes and she brings it to her brother Amnon in his bedroom. But when she took it to him, he grabbed her and said, come to bed with me, my sister. No, my brother. She said to him, don't force me. Don't do this wicked thing. What about me? Where could I get rid of my disgrace? And what about you? You would be one of the fools in Israel. Speak to the king. And she has, interestingly enough, a kind of a compromise. Now, marriage between half-brothers and sisters wasn't uncommon. Abraham and Sarah were half-brother and sister, according to the Bible, so maybe. But Amnon is not interested in a wife. He's just interested in an encounter. He's just full of lust. He is not disciplined. He's given himself over to lust. So there's a failure of discernment here on the part of King David. You know, Tamar was a princess. She was probably raised in a very isolated kind of setting from life and so forth. And so I can see how she might have been naive about men and the ways of men. And then verse 14, he refused to listen to her, and since he was stronger than she, he raped her. Verse 15, then she hated him with a hatred, intense hatred. He hated her more than he had loved her, lusted after her. Amnon said to her, get up and get out. No, she said, sending me away would be a greater wrong than what you've already done to me. He refused to listen to her. He calls a servant, sends her out. Get this woman out of my sight, bolt the door. So the servant does that, and they send her out. She was wearing an ornate robe, it says. This was the kind of garment the virgin daughters of the king wore. Tamar put ashes on her head. She tears the robe she was wearing. She puts hands on her heads and went away weeping aloud as she went. The writer wants us to see her here. The writer wants us to know and understand the pain and the desolation that she feels here, describing what she does, puts ashes on her head, tearing her robe. the writer's voice changes here into a voice of compassion for her. Then she runs into Absalom, and Absalom's, what is Absalom's, verse 20, her brother Absalom said to her, "Has that Amnon been with you? And isn't this an interesting question?" Absalom knew what Amnon had been up to with the lust that was in his heart. Surely he did. But what does he tell her? He says, "Be quiet. Don't take it to heart." In other words, this is a secret. This is a family. We protect our secrets in our family. We protect our sins. This is secrecy here, and this is part of a dysfunction of that in families. This is where also we know that Absalom knew what was going on. He had discerned this, but he did not use his discernment correctly. So keep quiet. This is a secret in our family. We keep our secrets and so forth. David had never corrected or disciplined his sons. They were children of privilege who had never learned to obey the moral. They knew the moral rule, but they never learned to obey it. They were not disciplined, had not learned to discipline themselves. They knew the moral code, but they thought it did not apply to them. They could break the rules, and if it did any harm to anybody, it was just a secret. We keep our secrets. David, verse 21, when King David heard all this, he was furious. But the NRSV says, going on some other Hebrew documents that we have, says, "And he did nothing." David did nothing. Now, in 1 Kings, the first chapter of 1 Kings, when another one of David's sons, after Absalom, tries to usurp the throne, we have the same thing said. He said this son was rebellious because David had never rebuked him. So David had this pattern of raising spoiled sons. Let's just put it in those terms. David had a pattern of never disciplining his sons and never teaching them to discipline themselves. Verse 22, Absalom never said a word to Amnon, either good or bad. He hated Amnon because he had disgraced his sister Tamar. And so, listen, everything is wrong here. The sons sin and cover it up. They hate each other, and they stop talking to each other. Tamar is devastated. No one comes to her aid. No one defends her. No one names the sin of her brother. No one calls Amnon out. Tamar, it says, is a desolate woman. David is angry, but he does nothing. He never has. Absalom hates his brother, never talks to him about raping his sister. He squashes his hatred down where it festers. For 2 years, it says. Amnon suffers no consequences for his sin, but later on we will see a consequence. Now, if this strikes home to any of you, let me just say this. No woman then or now should have to undergo this kind of treatment. No man should forsake their discernment and give way to lust. No sibling should have to live in the gloom of their sin, their hatred, and keep the secrets. That's not how God created us to be. Go back to Jeremiah 31. It's not how God created us to be. These things go against the moral code that Moses had laid down in the books of the law. Maybe the biggest thing to learn here is that parents should not let children or family members or grandchildren or cousins get by with sin. When parents create secrets out of sins, they will always come back even worse and more destructive. So, verse 23, 2 years later, Absalom has this hatred has been festering for 2 years, and and they haven't, and Amnon and Absalom are not talking to each other. Absalom is brooding over over this sin against his sister Tamar, who lives with him, and who we know he loves her dearly. He sees her desolation and he nurses his hatred of Amnon. So in verse 23, we have this time of shearing of the sheep. So shearing of the sheep in that culture, it was a springtime festival. It was a wonderful time. There were family reunions. Everybody came together, and the men went out and sheared the sheep, and the women cooked food, and they were, you know, they slaughtered a lamb and a cow, and they had all kinds of wonderful food. The tables were just groaning with everything good to eat. So it's a time of celebration and joy. Winter's gone, spring is here, and we have another year, and we're so happy for this. Absalom invites the whole family, but they don't come. Why would you come, right? After everything happened, why would you go to that family reunion, right? We all understand that. So verse 24, Absalom went to the king. Your servant has had cheers come. Will you, the king, and his attendants join me? David said, no. It will just be a burden. It will just be a bother to you. David didn't know what to do. Everything's a mess. Absalom urges him, it says, but he refused to go, but finally gave him his blessing. And then Absalom said, but so if you're not going to come, then can you at least send, you know, Amnon here with me? And David says, why should he go? You guys aren't even talking to each other. What are you going to talk about if he does come to see you? But Amnon urged him, verse 27, Amnon urged him, so he sent with him Amnon and the rest of the king's sons. Now, we don't know how many sons are, but it must have been a lot, because David had a lot of wives, he had a lot of children. Now, verse 28, we see the plan that Absalom had in mind. You might think that Absalom wanted to, well, we'll have a reunion, let's talk about things, we got to ask forgiveness, we got to make things right, we got to fix things, we have to have restoration and restitution. Unfortunately, that's not what was going to happen. He had a plot to kill Amnon. Not in some hidden way, not in an ambush, but in the middle of a family reunion. What horror. Everybody gets up and flees on their mules, it says. Now, this is an honor culture, so this is an honor killing, right? You dishonored my sister, you're going to pay with your life. I'm going to make you pay with your life for what you did to my sister. The news gets back to David. And the news is kind of twisted. It's not quite right, because the news in verse... somebody comes to David, verse 30, the last part of verse 30, and saying, Absalom has struck down all of your sons have been killed, right? Not one of them is left. David stands up, he tears his clothes, he falls down on the ground, and everybody tears their clothes, and this is weeping and mourning now. But enter, guess who? Jonadab, the crafty guy, right? Jonadab comes back. He says, my lord, my uncle, don't think they've killed everybody. They just killed Amnon, right? And then he says, don't take it to heart. That's what Absalom had told Tamar. Don't take it to heart, right? They just killed Amnon. I mean, look, what are you supposed to do? They just killed his son. Don't take it to heart that you were raped. Don't take it to heart that your son was murdered. Really? Absalom flees, of course. That's how it is with honor killing, because it just goes on and on. So he's going to have to leave now in order to save his life, because somebody's going to come and kill him, right? That's how it works in these honor cultures. So let's go on to verse chapter 14. I'll condense it here a bit. Joab comes. Absalom returns to Jerusalem. He's in verse 38 of chapter 13, he goes to Geshur for 3 years, and then he returns back to Jerusalem as we get move through this chapter. So Joab comes. Joab is thinking this family is getting a little out of hand. Things are really a mess. And then Joab remembers that story. Remember the story that Nathan tells David about the man, the rich man, the poor man. The rich man takes a little lamb. And this story is the story that shows David what he's really done with Bathsheba. And so Joab thinks, I'm going to think of a story like that. I'm going to find somebody to go in and play this out with David and see how this works. And so he does. He goes to Tekoa and he finds a wise woman, it says, a wise woman who can take this story and create this story and tell David this kind of story. And so this wise woman comes in and she says, I've got two sons and they got in a fight and one killed the other. And now there's this honor code thing and the clan is coming. They're going to kill my other son. I'm this poor widow and what am I going to do? You know, and David says, he falls for the story, and then she reveals her hand in verse 13 of chapter 14. Verse 13, the woman said, why then have you devised a thing against the people? She goes on and says, you need to let Absalom come back. Bring back your banished son, because David had said, I don't want to see Absalom anymore. Absalom has killed my son. I don't want to see him at all. Now, in verse 25, the author, again, trying to change his voice here and wants to show us how handsome Absalom is. Verse 25. Verse 25. In all Israel, there was not a man so highly praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the top of his head to the sole of his foot, there was not a blemish in him. Whenever he cut the hair of his head, he used to cut his hair once a year because it became too heavy for him, he would weigh it. I mean, who weighs their hair? Really? Is this conceit? Eric, you know, I don't know what this is. Getting ahead of myself here. But this is who Absalom is. He's handsome. He has illusions of grandeur. He's very vain. I don't know how else you can understand him at this way. He greatly loved Tamar, though. In verse 27, it says he had three sons, and then he had a daughter who he named Tamar. So he greatly loved his sister. Then he lived two more years in Jerusalem without seeing his father, a sign of dysfunction. So the story hasn't quite worked too well. And so he really wants to go see his father now. But David refuses, and so Absalom goes to Joab again, another cousin who's the commander of the army. Joab refuses to see him, and so Absalom sends men out to burn Joab's barley field down. And Joab goes to Absalom and says, why are you burning my field, dude, why are you doing this to me? And then Absalom says, I gotta talk to my dad. You're the only one that can help me. Go talk to my dad, right? So please, please, please help me do this. Finally, he does. So Absalom goes before the king. He prostrates himself on the ground and gets up. The king kisses him, and that's all. There's no resolution at all. So it's just a bunch of unresolved conflict. David and Absalom don't know how to resolve their bitterness. Absalom can't get over what happened to his sister because David doing nothing. David also can't get over his bitterness toward Absalom because Absalom killed his son, his brother, Absalom's brother. So there's no resolution here for the anger and dysfunction that they have toward each other. There's a verse in Hebrews 12, chapter 12, which talks about bitterness. And I just want to read it here. And it's a description of the dysfunction that comes from sinful behavior. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 14, it says, make every effort to live in peace with everyone and be holy. Without holiness, no one will see the Lord. Make sure that the root of bitterness, or see to it that no one falls short of the grace of God and that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many. Bitterness is embedded in the story of this family now. And it is, in fact, causing trouble, and it is defiling many people. Many people are suffering the consequences of the bitterness now that is growing up among in this family. So there's bitterness here, it's causing trouble, and it is defiling many. And to defile simply means to spoil something or to desecrate or mar something, to damage something. That's what defiling means. So chapter 15 opens up the plan that Absalom has now. After he's killed Amnon, Amnon is the oldest son, remember? So he's gotten rid of the oldest son. And we see the plan now in kind of full-blown plan that Absalom has. He wants to replace his father on the throne. That's what he's angling for now. Whether it comes from his bitterness, whether he's nurtured this a long time, we don't know, or whether this is just now coming saying, you know, this is a chance for me to move. David is in a weak position. There's a lot of animosity. He's lost credibility with people. Haha, maybe that's what he was thinking. I don't know. But that is very clearly his goal here now. Because what does he do? Look, chapter 15, verse 1. Absalom provided himself with a chariot and horses and 50 men to run ahead of him. They probably all carried all the hair that had been cut off in the years past. The Jews brought up. He would get up early and stand by the side of the gate leading to the city gate. Whenever anyone came with a complaint to be placed before the king for a decision, Absalom will call out to him and say, what town are you from? And he was getting their, you know, emails and phone numbers. What town are you from? And he would answer, I'm from, you know, one of the tribes of Israel. And then Absalom would say to him, look, the claim you have, the complaint you have to bring to the king is, you're right. The king should settle it in your favor, right? But he says, but there's no representative of the king to hear you. The king isn't doing his job. The king is just sitting in the palace. And here you have these complaints. He's not caring about anybody. But look, I think if I were king, I would give you what you want. And because this is what he says in verse 4, if only I were appointed judge in the land, wink, wink, king, then everyone who has a complaint or case would come to me and I would see that they would receive justice. Right? I'm for you. And he had this list that he was making, I'm sure, of all the people that he had talked to. So he does this for 4 years, riding around doing this in the various villages and towns and so forth. He's blaming his dad for all the bad things that are happening to people. I'm going to bring justice to the land. And through this kind of populist acting, he stole the people's hearts, it says. Verse 6, Absalom behaved in this way toward all the Israelites who came to the king asking for justice, and so he stole the hearts of the people of Israel. It was just talking, though. He didn't have any program. He wasn't really capable of being king and running a kingdom. Well, so he goes to Hebron, verse 7, he goes to Hebron, the place of worship. He gets David's blessing, but he has secret motives. And while there, he calls on the people to get ready to proclaim him king. Verse 10, he sent secret messages throughout the tribes of Israel to say, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpets, then say, Absalom is king in Hebron. Hebron is where people were anointed king, right? That's where David was anointed king and others too. 200 men from Jerusalem, remember, he had gotten all the names of people, had accompanied Absalom. They had been invited as guests and went innocently, knowing nothing about the matter. While Absalom was offering sacrifices, he sent for Ahithophel, the Gibeonite, David's counselor. Ahithophel was one of David's primary counselors. He comes up over and over again. to come from Gilah, his homeland. And so the conspiracy gained strength, and Absalom's followers kept on increasing. So David flees. Verse 13, a messenger came and told David, "The hearts of the people of Israel are with Absalom." Absalom has worked at this for 6 years, or 4 years at least, going around, getting actively creating a conspiracy, an insurgency against David. And now it's paying off for Absalom. David called, verse 14, David sent to all his officials who were with him in Jerusalem, "Come, we must flee." Now, this is the first time now for a couple chapters that we've seen David really active. And he's finally waking up to what's happening. He says, "I got to get out of here. We have to all go. We must flee, or none of us will escape from Absalom. We must leave immediately, or he will move quickly to overtake us and bring ruin on us and put the city to the sword." David now fully understands what Absalom is trying to do. And so they set out. Verse 16, the entire household following him. And so it gives all the places where they're marching and the people who are going with him. It names the Kerethites and the Pelethites and the Gittites who had accompanied him from Gath marched before the king. So this is not a very good place to end this. But the drama continues. It is kind of a soap opera, isn't it? So we'll continue this next week, looking at the dysfunction and the things that that are going out. More people come. There's Hushai and Ahithophel, who is a counselor. There's Hushai, and David is setting these, because David is showing some good discernment about what's going on and how he should respond here. But we'll pick up this on the next week. And we'll move through a couple more chapters, hopefully into 16, the end of 16 at least. Maybe 17 or 18, yeah. So what can we learn from this? Well, what we see happening is what Hebrews 12 teaches us, that if we allow a bitter root to grow up in our hearts, it will cause trouble and defile many. The bitter root will crowd out the things Paul speaks of in Ephesians 4. That was read, that Levon read. The second thing is, we prevent the effects of sin to go into dysfunction and a bitter root from springing up by living with good discernment and discipline in our own lives. 3, we need to teach our children and grandchildren and cousins and anybody else in our family and encourage everyone to use good discernment and discipline in our lives, learning how to judge well and obey moral rules. David was able to confess his sins to God. Just read the Psalm. Read Psalm 51 or Psalm 63 that we read this morning. There are a lot of Psalms in there that David wrote in which he confesses his sins. But how about with his family? It seems his children never saw humility or sorrow for sins in David's actual life, in his relationship with them. I don't know where he wrote the Psalms that he did. Maybe his children never read the Psalms. Maybe he never talked about these things. But are we teaching these to our own families as parents and grandparents here? Do we show humility? Do we show our struggle to not let the root of bitterness grow up in our own hearts? Do we show that and teach that to our own family and friends, cousins and siblings? The writer of 2 Samuel shows us these things so we can learn how to live with discernment and discipline. The Apostle Paul had learned his lesson well also, I'm sure, and describes in his letter to the Ephesians how we can root out our lust and bitterness and anger in our own life and replace it with compassion. So let's pray together this morning. Our God, we're grateful for the record we have in the Bible, not just of your mighty deeds in the Old Testament and the record of Jesus the Christ, who came to give us the good news of the gospel. We're grateful for the record of the failures and the sins and the dysfunction that is described for us. So help us to put into practice what Paul teaches us in Ephesians 4, to get rid of bitterness, anger, and malice, and to be kind and compassionate, just as you, through Jesus the Christ, are compassionate with us. And we pray that in his name. Amen.